Anthony Holden spent a year as a professional poker player. He was the one at the table taking notes. Holden is a journalist. He's written biographies of Prince Charles and Laurence Olivier. He's also worked for the London Sunday Times and The Observer. But his new book is about his year playing poker for big stakes in gaudy casinos around the world. It's called Big Deal. Holden is a veteran of Tuesday night poker games. I asked him what it means to turn pro in a game played by millions of amateurs.
Well, a pro is basically somebody who earns a living doing it, which is not easy to do. But there are several hundred people, mostly in the western United States, who manage that. And there's a handful of Europeans. And what they do is spend their year traveling around a circuit. Poker has a circuit, like golf or tennis has a circuit, punctuated by various big-time tournaments. And, of course, old-time hustling still goes on. At a phone call, they'll get on a plane and go anywhere where the action is.
Now, why did you want to turn pro for a year?
Well, it happened to me by mistake, really. It comes in the category of a fantasy thing of giving up your job to go and do what you've always wanted to do. I've played in an amateur down-home poker game in London for about 20 years, and I'd been going to Las Vegas each May when they have the World Championships for about 10 years as a journalist to watch, because it cost $10,000 to enter, and that's an awful lot of money at the best of times. It's an awful lot of money to hand over to those sharks in 5 minutes. What happened to me in May 88 was that I arrived there and they were taking names for what they call a satellite, which is like a heat, where you put up $1,000, 10 people put up $1,000 each, play till somebody's won the lot, and that person gets into the 10,000 event for just one. It was the night I got there. I was a bit jet-lagged. I confess I'd had a couple of glasses of wine. Don't remember a whole lot about it, but I must have done something right because I won this thing and found myself playing in the World Championships. This thing goes on for 4 days. It starts with about 200 people who've paid 10,000 each, so there's about 2 million in prize money. And I lasted towards the end of the second day, and I came out 90th out of 200, which wasn't too bad for a British amateur. Got back to England, couldn't talk about anything else. And my then girlfriend, now my wife, who figures in the book as the mole, it was her idea, really, that I'd become so boring on this subject that I should just drop everything and spend a year seeing if I could pay my way.
Give us a sense of what your itinerary was, traveling around from one poker table to another for a year.
Yes, you're bobbing back and forth between tournament tables and real money tables. If I can explain the distinction, how I tried to achieve limited liability was to hit the tournament circuit, where maybe you have to pay $1,000 or $1,500 to enter a tournament, but at least that's all you can lose. In a regular poker game, of course, if you lose that, then you just dig in your pocket for more. So I was bobbing around between tournaments and real money, mostly in Nevada and California, but there were some other events. Americans come over to Europe for the European Championships, which float around. That year they were in Malta.
When you're at a casino and the people there know that you're going to be playing for big money, what are some of the perks that you get?
Oh, well, you get, as they call it, comped. When I arrive in Vegas, now that I'm a regular, I have a big white stretch limo to meet me, a big, burly, terrifyingly strong-looking man to carry my suitcases, and you feel like a high roller before you've even left the airport. Then your sense of money begins to go askew and you feel that you can't tip this guy anything less than $50, which, of course, it would have been cheaper to go by taxi, but that's what being a high roller is all about. The hotel room is free. Most of the meals are free. So you can live very cheaply in Las Vegas if they decide they like you and if you're going to risk some money in their casino.
So what kinds of people did you play with in Vegas, for instance? What kinds of people did you play with at the World Series?
Well, part of the joy of the whole thing was that there's such wonderful, colorful, and very nice characters on the circuit. They really broadly divide into two groups. There are the old-timers who are getting on a bit now, and these are the colorful people like you see in the movies who wear Stetson hats and bootlace ties and cowboy boots and amazingly bulbous jewelry, which is a status symbol among poker players, gold encrusted rings and massive watches with diamonds glinting off them. They're wonderful talkers. And the younger pros who are beginning to take over now arrive at the table in tracksuits and trainers, and they really have been out jogging, these guys, and they don't smoke, and they don't drink, and they don't go nightclubbing, and take it very seriously, and they're physical athletes as well as mental athletes. These tournaments go on a long time. They have to have powers of endurance.
Do you find that you have to be good at reading character to be a good poker player?
Very much so, yeah. That's why I think poker, as I argue in the book, is really a paradigm for life. We all bluff our way through certain situations every day. And the main requirement, if you sit down in Las Vegas or wherever at a table full of strangers, it's obviously a completely different proposition from sitting down at home with people you know inside out. And what I've got to do, or anybody else sitting down there, is evaluate these people as fast as I can. Are they rich? Are they poor? Are they happy? Are they sad? Have they got out of bed the wrong side this morning? Have they had a row with their spouse on the way to the casino? And of course, my trouble is, as soon as I open my mouth, if only to say fold or raise, they say, "Hey, London, how are you doing?" And they can assume from hearing my accent that I don't really know what I'm doing, which a lot of the time is true. So reading character, there's a lot of body language involved. You can tell whether people are bluffing from the way they sit, the way they perhaps tug their earlobe, things like that. That's, to me, is the fascination of it, is the kind of psychological warfare.
You say that the real pro poker players have one remarkable quality in common. They have a serene indifference to the worldly attributes of money. How did you see that around you?
I think in the end, that is what sets these people apart. What they say is that money's not important. Money is just a method of keeping score. It sounds very pretentious, but in fact, it's true, I think. What I mean by that is that if in those circles the bets can be in several thousand dollars, if somebody's betting $2,000 at me, I'm thinking, my God, this is a Cadillac, or this is a down payment on an apartment I could win here, or it's my children's school fees, or whatever. If you start relating it to real life, then your judgment begins to go awry. You just have to think of it as 2,000 units, think on the odds they're offering you. As long as you're doing that, you're playing rationally. In England, I keep it all in a separate bank account so that it doesn't relate to real life, and that's been very successful. But these pros can deal in huge amounts of money without thinking of them in materialistic terms at all.
What was your initial bankroll when you started?
I started out with $20,000, which sounds a lot and is a lot, but it's not a lot in that particular world. And it had dwindled down to an alarmingly low level, about $2,500 or $3,000. But I had a great turnaround weekend and was able to win the $10,000 to get into the World Series and even finish ahead.
Now, your grandfather was a millionaire who lost his fortune before you were born.
That's right.
Do you think having that kind of wealth in your family, formerly in your family, affected your view of money?
Well, I think maybe resentment that wealth isn't in my family anymore, sure, is a factor in all this. And I went to a shrink for the purposes of the book to find out why I felt I had this need for risk of a kind that most people don't seem to have in my walk of life. And he related it, a lot of it, to my family background and the fact that my father, an otherwise upright member of a Northwest community in England, lost on the troop ship back from the war in 1945. He lost £50 sterling playing poker, which is an awful lot of money at the time, everything he had in the world. So although I grew up in a very card-playing family where we played canasta and bridge and everything you can think of, poker was strictly banned. And I got rumbled in my early 20s when I was playing bridge with my parents. They're very keen bridge players. I wasn't playing very well. My mother, as people do if they take bridge seriously, lost her temper with me and said, "I can't understand why you're always overbidding." And I said, "Well, first of all, I don't like to have a partner. I'd rather be in charge of my own destiny. Secondly, I can't take all these conventions at bridge where if you say spades, you really mean hearts and things like that. And thirdly, of course, I'm always overbidding because I don't want to be dummy. I don't see the point of a game where you don't get to play." And this is a poker player speaking. Poker players are individualists. They don't want to have partners. And so I was rumbled. They said, "You're playing poker, aren't you?" And they found out. But my dad had a glint in his eye about it. And the shrink told me that I was kind of finishing off something my father started.
You're back at your Tuesday night poker game?
Oh, sure, yes. Well, there's a lot of joshing now. What's the pro going to do?
So is your playing different at the Tuesday night game now that you've had a year as a pro?
I think it's better, yes. And certainly during that year, whenever I got back home, and again, there was a lot of teasing going on, I whopped him week by week because my I had much better idea in my head of the odds on the cards. I used to play from the gut, as it were, like most people do, play by instinct. But now I was playing more scientifically, and it worked. That's really the point in the end about poker, is that all other forms of gambling, casino games, blackjack, roulette, horses, whatever, you are wagering unfavorable odds. You may have a thrilling win, you see it happen at the roulette table, but you're going to lose in the end. Poker, if you know what you're doing, if you have the odds in your head, you're wagering favorable odds, and you may have a bad setback where the odds defy you, but you're going to win in the end, and that's what these people manage to do.
Well, Anthony Holden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Anthony Holden's new book is called Big Deal, A Year as a Professional Poker Player.